Chapter 2. The Brain Attic. What is it, and what's in there? One of the most widely held notions about Sherlock Holmes has to do with his supposed ignorance of Copernican theory. "What the deuce is the solar system to me?" he exclaims to Watson in A Study in Scarlet. "You say that we go round the sun. If we went round the moon, it would not make a pennyworth of difference to me or to my work." And now that he knows that fact, "I shall do my best to forget it," he promises. It's fun to home in on that incongruity between the superhuman-seeming detective and a failure to grasp a fact so rudimentary that even a child would know it. And ignorance of the solar system is quite an omission for someone who we might hold up as the model of the scientific method, is it not? Even the BBC series Sherlock can't help but use it as a focal point of one of its episodes. But two things about that perception bear further mention. First, it isn't, strictly speaking, true. Witness Holmes's repeated references to astronomy in future stories. In The Musgrave Ritual, he talks about allowances for personal equation, as the astronomers would have it. In The Greek Interpreter, about the obliquity of the ecliptic. In The Adventure of the Bruce Partington Plans, about a planet leaving its orbit. Indeed, eventually Holmes does use almost all of the knowledge that he denies having at the earliest stages of his friendship with Dr. Watson. And in true to canon form, Sherlock the BBC series does end on a note of scientific triumph. Holmes does know astronomy after all, and that knowledge saves the day and the life of the little boy. In fact, I would argue that he exaggerates his ignorance precisely to draw our attention to a second, and I think much more important, point. His supposed refusal to commit the solar system to memory serves to illustrate an analogy for the human mind that will prove to be central to Holmes's thinking and to our ability to emulate his methodology. As Holmes tells Watson, moments after the Copernican incident, "I consider that a man's brain originally is like a little empty attic, and you have to stock it with such furniture as you choose." When I first heard the term brain attic, back in the days of firelight and the old crimson hardcover, all I could picture in my 7-year-old head was the cover of the black-and-white Shel Silverstein book that sat prominently on my bookshelf, with its half-smiling, lopsided face, whose forehead was distended to a wrinkled triangle, complete with roof, chimney, and window with open shutters. Behind the shutters, a tiny face peeking out at the world. Is this what Holmes meant? A small room with sloped sides and a foreign creature with a funny face waiting to pull the cord and turn the light off or on? As it turns out, I wasn't far from wrong. For Sherlock Holmes, a person's brain attic really is an incredibly concrete physical space. Maybe it has a chimney, maybe it doesn't. But whatever it looks like, it is a space in your head, specially fashioned for storing the most disparate of objects. And yes, there is certainly a cord that you can pull to turn the light on or off at will. As Holmes explains to Watson, "A fool takes in all the lumber of every sort that he comes across, so that the knowledge which might be useful to him gets crowded out, or at best is jumbled up with a lot of other things, so that he has a difficulty in laying his hands upon it. Now the skillful workman is very careful indeed as to what he takes into his brain attic." That comparison, as it turns out, is remarkably accurate. Subsequent research on memory formation, retention, and retrieval has, as you'll soon see, proven itself to be highly amenable to the attic analogy. In the chapters that follow, we will trace the role of the brain attic from the inception to the culmination of the thought process, exploring how its structure and content work at every point, and what we can do to improve that working on a regular basis. The attic can be broken down, roughly speaking, into two components, structure and contents. The attic structure is how our mind works, how it takes in information, how it processes that information, how it sorts it and stores it for the future, how it may choose to integrate it or not with contents that are already in the attic space. Unlike a physical attic, the structure of the brain attic isn't altogether fixed. It can expand, albeit not indefinitely, or it can contract, depending on how we use it. In other words, our memory and processing can become more or less effective. It can change its mode of retrieval. How do I recover information I've stored? It can change its storage system. How do I deposit information I've taken in? Where will it go? How will it be marked? How will it be integrated? At the end, it will have to remain within certain confines. Each attic, once again, is different and subject to its unique constraints. But within those confines, it can take on any number of configurations, depending on how we learn to approach it. The attic's contents, on the other hand, are those things that we've taken in from the world and that we've experienced in our lives. Our memories, our past, the base of our knowledge, the information we start with every time we face a challenge. And just like a physical attic's contents can change over time, so too does our mind attic continue to take in and discard items until the very end. As our thought process begins, the furniture of memory combines with the structure of internal habits and external circumstances to determine which item will be retrieved from storage at any given point. Guessing at the contents of a person's attic from his outward appearance becomes one of Sherlock's surest ways of determining who that person is and what he is capable of. As we've already seen, much of the original intake is outside of our control. Just like we must picture a pink elephant to realize one doesn't exist, we can't help but become acquainted, if only for the briefest of moments, with the workings of the solar system or the writings of Thomas Carlyle, should Watson choose to mention them to us. We can, however, learn to master many aspects of our attic structure, throwing out junk that got in by mistake. As Holmes promises to forget Copernicus at the earliest opportunity, prioritizing those things we want to, and pushing back those that we don't. Learning how to take the contours of our unique attic into account so that they don't unduly influence us as they otherwise might. While we may never become quite as adept as the master at divining a man's innermost thoughts from his exterior, in learning to understand the layout and functionality of our own brain attic, we take the first step to becoming better at exploiting its features to their maximum potential. In other words, to learning how to optimize our own thought process so that we start any given decision or action as our best, most aware selves. Our attic structure and contents aren't there because we have to think that way, but because we've learned over time and with repeat practice, often unknown, but practice nevertheless, to think that way. We've decided, on a certain level, that mindful attention is just not worth the effort. We've chosen efficiency over depth. It may take just as long, but we can learn to think differently. The basic structure may be there for good, but we can learn to alter its exact linkages and building blocks. And that alteration will actually rebuild the attic, so to speak, rewiring our neural connections as we change our habits of thought. Just as with any renovation, some of the major overhauls may take some time. You can't just rebuild an attic in a day. But some minor changes will likely begin to appear within days, and even hours. And they will do so no matter how old your attic is, and how long it has been since it's gotten a proper cleaning. In other words, our brains can learn new skills quickly, and they can continue to do so throughout our lives, not just when we are younger. As for the contents, while some of those, too, are there to stay, we can be selective about what we keep in the future, and can learn to organize the attic so that those contents we do want are easiest to access, and those we either value less or want to avoid altogether move further into the corners. We may not come out with an altogether different attic, but we can certainly come out with one that more resembles Holmes's. Memories furniture. The same day that Watson first learns of his new friend's theories on deduction, all of that Niagara from a drop of water and whatnot, he is presented with a most convincing demonstration of their power, their application to a puzzling murder. As the two men sit discussing Holmes's article, they are interrupted by a message from Scotland Yard. Inspector Tobias Gregson requests Holmes's opinion on a puzzler of a case. A man has been found dead, and yet, there has been no robbery, nor is there any evidence as to how the man met his death. There are marks of blood in the room, but there is no wound upon his person. Gregson continues his appeal. We are at a loss as to how he came into the empty house. Indeed, the whole affair is a puzzler. And without further ado, Holmes departs for Lauriston Gardens, Watson at his side. Is the case as singular as all that? Gregson and his colleague, Inspector Lestrade, seem to think so. It beats anything I have seen, and I am no chicken, offers Lestrade. Not a clue in sight. Holmes, however, has an idea. Of course, this blood belongs to a second individual, presumably the murderer, if murder has been committed, he tells the two policemen. It reminds me of the circumstances attendant on the death of Van Janssen in Utrecht in the year 34. Do you remember the case, Gregson? Gregson confesses that he does not. Read it up. You really should, offers Holmes. There is nothing new under the sun. It has all been done before. Why does Holmes remember Van Janssen while Gregson does not? Presumably, both men had at one point been acquainted with the circumstances. After all, Gregson has had to train extensively for his current position, and yet the one has retained them for his use, while for the other, they have evaporated into non-existence. It all has to do with the nature of the brain attic. Our default system Watson attic is jumbled and largely mindless. Gregson may have once known about Van Janssen, but has lacked the requisite motivation and presence to retain his knowledge. Why should he care about old cases? Holmes, however, makes a conscious, motivated choice to remember cases past. One never knows when they might come in handy. In his attic, knowledge does not get lost. He has made a deliberate decision that these details matter, and that decision has, in turn, affected how and what and when he remembers. Our memory is in large part the starting point for how we think, how our preferences form, and how we make decisions. It is the attic's content that distinguishes even an otherwise identically structured mind from its neighbors. What Holmes means when he talks about stocking your attic with the appropriate furniture is the need to carefully choose which experiences, which memories, which aspects of your life you want to hold on to beyond the moment when they occur. He should know. He would not have even existed as we know him had Arthur Conan Doyle not retrieved his experiences with Dr. Joseph Bell from memory in creating his fictional detective. He means that for a police inspector, it would be well to remember past cases, even seemingly obscure ones. Aren't they, in a sense, the most basic knowledge of his profession? In the earliest days of research, memory was thought to be populated with so-called engrams, memory traces that were localized in specific parts of the brain. To locate one such engram, for the memory of a maze, psychologist Carl Lashley taught rats to run through a labyrinth. He then cut out various parts of their brain tissue and put them right back into the maze. Though the rats' motor function declined, and some had to hobble or crawl their way woozily through the twists and turns, the animals never altogether forgot their way, leading Lashley to conclude that there was no single location that stored a given memory. Rather, memory was widely distributed in a connected neural network, one that may look rather familiar to Holmes. Today, it is commonly accepted that memory is divided into two systems, one short and one long-term. While the precise mechanisms of the systems remain theoretical, an attic-like view, albeit a very specific kind of attic, may not be far from the truth. When we see something, it is first encoded by the brain and then stored in the hippocampus. Think of it as the attic's first entry point, where you place everything before you know whether or not you will need to retrieve it. From there, the stuff that you either actively consider important or that your mind somehow decides is worth storing based on past experience and your past directives, that is, what you normally consider important, will be moved to a specific box within the attic, into a specific folder, in a specific compartment in the cortex. The bulk of your attic storage space, your long-term memory. This is called consolidation. When you need to recall a specific memory that has been stored, your mind goes to the proper file and pulls it out. Sometimes it pulls out the file next to it, too, activating the contents of the whole box or whatever happens to be nearby. Associative activation. Sometimes the file slips, and by the time you get it out into the light, its contents have changed from when you first placed them inside, only you may not be aware of the change. In any case, you take a look, and you add anything that may seem newly relevant. Then you replace it in its spot in its changed form. Those steps are called retrieval and reconsolidation, respectively. The specifics aren't nearly as important as the broad idea. Some things get stored. Some are thrown out and never reach the main attic. What's stored is organized according to some associative system. Your brain decides where a given memory might fit. But if you think you'll be retrieving an exact replica of what you've stored, you're wrong. Contents shift, change, and reform with every shake of the box where they are stored. Put in your favorite book from childhood, and if you're not careful, the next time you retrieve it, there may be water damage to the picture you so wanted to see. Throw a few photo albums up there, and the pictures may get mixed together so that the images from one trip merge with those from another one altogether. Reach for an object more often, and it doesn't gather dust. It stays on top, fresh and ready for your next touch. Though who knows what it may take with it on its next trip out. Leave it untouched, and it retreats further and further into a heap, but it can be dislodged by a sudden movement in its vicinity. Forget about something for long enough, and by the time you go to look for it, it may be lost beyond your reach. Still there, to be sure, but at the bottom of a box in a dark corner where you aren't likely to ever find it again. To cultivate our knowledge actively, we need to realize that items are being pushed into our attic space at every opportunity. In our default state, we don't often pay attention to them unless some aspect draws our attention. But that doesn't mean they haven't found their way into our attic all the same. They sneak in if we're not careful, if we just passively take in information and don't make a conscious effort to control our attention. Something we'll learn about a bit further on, especially if they are things that somehow pique our attention naturally. Topics of general interest, things we can't help but notice, things that raise some emotion in us, or things that capture us by some aspect of novelty or note. It is all too easy to let the world come unfiltered into your attic space, populating it with whatever inputs may come its way, or whatever naturally captures your attention by virtue of its interest or immediate relevance to you. When we're in our default system Watson mode, we don't choose which memories to store. They just kind of store themselves, or they don't, as the case may be. Have you ever found yourself reliving a memory with a friend? That time you both ordered ice cream sundae instead of lunch, and then spent the afternoon walking around the town center and people watching by the river, only to find that the friend has no idea what you're talking about? "It must have been someone else," he says. "Not me. I'm not a Sunday type of guy." Only you know it was him. Conversely, have you ever been on the receiving end of that story? Having someone recount an experience or event or moment that you simply have no recollection of? And you can bet that that someone is just as certain as you were that it happened just the way he recalls. But that, warns Holmes, is a dangerous policy. Before you know it, your mind will be filled with so much useless junk that even the information that happened to be useful is buried so deeply and is so inaccessible that it might as well not even be there. It's important to keep one thing in mind. We know only what we can remember at any given point. In other words, no amount of knowledge will save us if we can't recall it at the moment we need it. It doesn't matter if the modern Holmes knows anything about astronomy if he can't remember the timing of the asteroid that appears in a certain painting at the crucial moment. A boy will die, and Benedict Cumberbatch will upset our expectations. It doesn't matter if Gregson once knew of Van Janssen and all his Utrecht adventures. If he can't remember them at Lauriston Gardens, they do him no good whatsoever. When we try to recall something, we won't be able to do so if there is too much piled up in the way. Instead, competing memories will vie for our attention. I may try to remember that crucial asteroid and think instead of an evening where I saw a shooting star, or what my astronomy professor was wearing when she first lectured to us about comets. It all depends on how well organized my attic is. how I encoded the memory to begin with, what cues are prompting its retrieval now, how methodical and organized my thought process is from start to finish. I may have stored something in my attic, but whether or not I have done so accurately and in a way that can be accessed in a timely fashion is another question altogether. It's not as simple as getting one discrete item out whenever I want it just because I once stuffed it up there. But that need not be the case. Inevitably, junk will creep into the attic. It's impossible to be as perfectly vigilant as Holmes makes himself out to be. You'll learn later that he isn't quite as strict either. Useless junk may end up being flea market gold in the right set of circumstances. But it is possible to assert more control over the memories that do get encoded. If Watson, or Gregson as the case may be, wanted to follow Holmes's method, he would do well to realize the motivated nature of encoding. We remember more when we are interested and motivated. Chances are, Watson was quite capable of retaining his medical training and the minutiae of his romantic escapades. These were things that were relevant to him and captured his attention. In other words, he was motivated to remember. Psychologist Karim Kassam calls it the Scooter Libby effect. During his 2007 trial, Lewis Scooter Libby claimed no memory of having mentioned the identity of a certain CIA employee to any reporters of government officials. The jurors didn't buy it. How could he not remember something so important? Simple. It wasn't nearly as important at the time as it was in retrospect, and where motivation matters most is at the moment we are storing memories in our attics to begin with, and not afterward. The so-called motivation to remember, MTR, is far more important at the point of encoding, and no amount of MTR at retrieval will be efficient if the information wasn't properly stored to begin with. As hard as it is to believe, Libby may well have been telling the truth. We can take advantage of MTR by activating the same processes consciously when we need them. When we really want to remember something, we can make a point of paying attention to it, of saying to ourselves, "This I want to remember," and, if possible, solidifying it as soon as we can, whether it be by describing an experience to someone else or to ourselves, if no one else is available. In essence, rehearsing it to help consolidation. Manipulating information, playing around with it, and talking it through, making it come alive through stories and gestures, may be much more effective in getting it to the attic when you want it to get there than just trying to think it over and over. In one study, for instance, students who explained mathematical material after reading it once did better on a later test than those who repeated that material several times. What's more, the more cues we have, the better the likelihood of successful retrieval. Had Gregson originally focused on all of the Utrecht details at the moment he first learned of the case, sights, smells, sounds, whatever else was in the paper that day, and had he puzzled over the case in various guises, he would be far more likely to recall it now. Likewise, had he linked it to his existing knowledge base, in other words, instead of moving a fresh box or folder into his attic, had he integrated it into an existing related one, be it on the topic of bloody crime scenes with bloodless bodies, or cases from 1834, or whatever else, the association would later facilitate a prompt response to Holmes's question. Anything to distinguish it and make it somehow more personal, relatable, and, crucially, memorable. Holmes remembers the details that matter to him, and not those that don't. At any given moment, you only think you know what you know. But what you really know is what you can recall. So what determines what we can and can't remember at a specific point in time? How is the content of our attic activated by its structure? The color of bias, the attic's default structure. It is autumn 1888, and Sherlock Holmes is bored. For months, no case of note has crossed his path. And so the detective takes solace, to Dr. Watson's great dismay, in the 7% solution, cocaine. According to Holmes, it stimulates and clarifies his mind, a necessity when no food for thought is otherwise available. Count the cost. Watson tries to reason with his flatmate. Your brain may, as you say, be roused and excited, but it is a pathological and morbid process which involves increased tissue change and may at least leave a permanent weakness. You know, too, what a black reaction comes upon you. Surely the game is hardly worth the candle. Holmes remains unconvinced. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram or the most intricate analysis, he says, and I am in my own proper atmosphere. I can dispense then with artificial stimulant, but I abhor the dull routine of existence. And none of Dr. Watson's best medical arguments will make a jot of difference, at least not for now. Luckily, however, in this particular instance, they don't need to. A crisp knock on the door, and the men's landlady, Mrs. Hudson, enters with an announcement. A young lady by the name of Miss Mary Morstan has arrived to see Sherlock Holmes. Watson describes Mary's entrance. Miss Morstan entered the room with a firm step and an outward composure of manner. She was a blonde young lady, small, dainty, well-gloved, and dressed in the most perfect taste. There was, however, a plainness and simplicity about her costume which bore with it a suggestion of limited means. The dress was a somber grayish beige, untrimmed and unbraided, and she wore a small turban of the same dull hue, relieved only by a suspicion of white feather in the side. Her face had neither regularity of feature nor beauty of complexion, but her expression was sweet and amiable, and her large blue eyes were singularly spiritual and sympathetic. In an experience of women which extends over many nations and three separate continents, I have never looked upon a face which gave a clearer promise of a refined and sensitive nature. I could not but observe that as she took the seat which Sherlock Holmes placed for her, her lip trembled, her hand quivered, and she showed every sign of intense inward agitation. Who might this lady be? And what could she want with the detective? These questions form the starting point of The Sign of Four, an adventure that will take Holmes and Watson to India and the Andaman Islands, pygmies and men with wooden legs. But before any of that, there's the lady herself. Who she is, what she represents, where she will lead. And in a few pages, we will examine the first encounter between Mary, Holmes, and Watson, and contrast the two very different ways in which the men react to their visitor. But first, let's take a step back to consider what happens in our mind attic when we first enter a situation, or, as in the case of The Sign of Four, encounter a person. How do those contents that we've just examined actually become activated? From the very first, our thinking is governed by our attic's so-called structure, its habitual modes of thought and operation, the way in which we've learned over time to look at and evaluate the world, the biases and heuristics that shape our intuitive, immediate perception of reality. Though, as we've just seen, the memories and experiences stored in an individual attic vary greatly from person to person, the general patterns of activation and retrieval remain remarkably similar, coloring our thought process in a predictable, characteristic fashion. And if these habitual patterns point to one thing, it's this. Our minds love nothing more than jumping to conclusions. Imagine for a moment that you're at a party. You're standing in a group of friends and acquaintances, chatting happily away, drink in hand, when you glimpse a stranger angling his way into the conversation. By the time he has opened his mouth, even before he has even quite made it to the group's periphery, you have doubtless already formed any number of preliminary impressions, creating a fairly complete, albeit potentially inaccurate, picture of who this stranger is as a person. How is Joe Stranger dressed? Is he wearing a baseball hat? You love, hate, baseball. This must be a great, boring guy. How does he walk and hold himself? What does he look like? Oh, is he starting to bald? What a downer. Does he actually think he can hang with someone as young and hip as you? What does he seem like? You've likely assessed how similar or different he is from you. Same gender, race, social background, economic means, and have even assigned him a preliminary personality. Shy, outgoing, nervous, self-confident, based on his appearance and demeanor alone. Or maybe Joe Stranger is actually Jane Stranger, and her hair is dyed the same shade of blue as your childhood best friend dyed her hair right before you stopped talking to each other, and you always thought the hair was the first sign of your impending break. And now all of a sudden, all of these memories are clogging your brain and coloring the way you see this new person, innocent Jane. You don't even notice anything else. As Joe or Jane start talking, you'll fill in the details, perhaps rearranging some, amplifying others, even deleting a few entirely. But you'll hardly ever alter your initial impression, the one that started to form the second Joe or Jane walked your way. And yet, what is that impression based on? Is it really anything of substance? You only happen to remember your ex-best friend, for instance, because of an errant streak of hair. When we see Joe or Jane, each question we ask ourselves and each detail that filters into our minds, floating, so to speak, through the little attic window, primes our minds by activating specific associations. And those associations cause us to form a judgment about someone we have never even met, let alone spoken to. You may want to hold yourself above such prejudices, but consider this. The Implicit Association Test, IAT, measures the distance between your conscious attitudes, those you are aware of holding, and your unconscious ones, those that form the invisible framework of your attic, beyond your immediate awareness. The measure can test for implicit bias toward any number of groups, though the most common one tests racial biases, by looking at reaction times for associations between positive and negative attributes and pictures of group representatives. Sometimes the stereotypical positives are represented by the same key. European American and good, for instance, are both associated with, say, the I key, and African American and bad with the E key. Sometimes they are represented by different ones. Now, the I is for African American and good, while European American has moved to the bad E key. Your speed of categorization in each of these circumstances determines your implicit bias. To take the racial example, if you are faster to categorize when European American and good share a key, and African American and bad share a key, it is taken as evidence of an implicit race bias. The findings are robust and replicated extensively. Even those individuals who score the absolute lowest on self-reported measures of stereotype attitudes, for example, on a 4-point scale ranging from strongly female to strongly male, do you most strongly associate career with male or female? Often show a difference in reaction time on the IAT that tells a different story. On the race-related attitudes IAT, about 68% of over 2.5 million participants show a biased pattern. On age, that is, those who prefer young people over old, 80%. On disability, that is, those who favor people without any disabilities, 76%. On sexual orientation, that is, those who favor straight people over gay, 68%. On weight, that is, those who favor thin people over fat, 69%. The list goes on and on. And those biases, in turn, affect our decision-making. How we see the world to begin with will impact what conclusions we reach, what evaluations we form, and what choices we make at any given point. This is not to say that we will necessarily act in a biased fashion. We are perfectly capable of resisting our brain's basic impulses. But it does mean that the biases are there at a very fundamental level. Protest as you may that it's just not you, but more likely than not, it is. Hardly anyone is immune altogether. Our brains are wired for quick judgments, equipped with back roads and shortcuts that simplify the task of taking in and evaluating the countless inputs that our environment throws at us every second. It's only natural. If we truly contemplated every element, we'd be lost. We'd be stuck. We'd never be able to move beyond that first evaluative judgment. In fact, we may not be able to make any judgment at all. Our world would become far too complex far too quickly. As William James put it, if we remembered everything, we should on most occasions be as ill off as if we remembered nothing. Our way of looking at and thinking about the world is tough to change, and our biases are remarkably sticky. But tough and sticky doesn't mean unchangeable and immutable. Even the IAT, as it turns out, can be bested. After interventions and mental exercises that target the very biases it tests, that is. For instance, if you show individuals pictures of blacks enjoying a picnic before you have them take the racial IAT, the bias score decreases significantly. A Holmes and a Watson may both make instantaneous judgments, but the shortcuts their brains are using could not be more different. Whereas Watson epitomizes the default brain, the structure of our mind's connections in their usual, largely passive state, Holmes shows what is possible, how we can rewire that structure to circumvent those instantaneous reactions that prevent a more objective and thorough judgment of our surroundings. For instance, consider the use of the IAT in a study of medical bias. First, each doctor was shown a picture of a 50-year-old man. In some pictures, the man was white. In some, he was black. The physicians were then asked to imagine the man in the picture as a patient who presented with symptoms that resembled a heart attack. How would they treat him? Once they gave an answer, they took the racial IAT. In one regard, the results were typical. Most doctors showed some degree of bias on the IAT. But then, an interesting thing happened. Bias on the test did not necessarily translate into bias in treating the hypothetical patient. On average, doctors were just as likely to say they would prescribe the necessary drugs to blacks as to whites, and oddly enough, the more seemingly biased physicians actually treated the two groups more equally than the less biased ones. What our brains do on the level of instinct and how we act are not one and the same. Does this mean that biases disappeared? That their brains didn't leap to conclusions from implicit associations that occurred at the most basic level of cognition? Hardly. But it does mean that the right motivation can counteract such bias and render it beside the point in terms of actual behavior. How our brains jump to conclusions is not how we are destined to act. Ultimately, our behavior is ours to control, if only we want to do so. What happened when you saw Joe Stranger at the cocktail party is the exact same thing that happens even to someone as adept at observation as Mr. Sherlock Holmes. But just like the doctors who have learned over time to judge based on certain symptoms and disregard others as irrelevant, Holmes has learned to filter his brain's instincts into those that should and those that should not play into his assessment of an unknown individual. What enables Holmes to do this? To observe the process in action, let's revisit that initial encounter in The Sign of Four, when Mary Morstan, the mysterious lady caller, first makes her appearance. Do the two men see Mary in the same light? Not at all. The first thing Watson notices is the lady's appearance. She is, he remarks, a rather attractive woman. Irrelevant, counters Holmes. It is of the first importance not to allow your judgment to be biased by personal qualities, he explains. A client is to me a mere unit, a factor in a problem. The emotional qualities are antagonistic to clear reasoning. I assure you that the most winning woman I ever knew was hanged for poisoning three children for their insurance money. And the most repellent man of my acquaintance is a philanthropist who has spent nearly a quarter of a million upon the London poor. But Watson won't have it. In this case, however, he interrupts. Holmes shakes his head. I never make exceptions. An exception disproves the rule. Holmes's point is clear enough. It's not that you won't experience emotion, nor are you likely to be able to suspend the impressions that form almost automatically in your mind. Of Miss Morstan, he remarks, I think she is one of the most charming young ladies I ever met, as high a compliment from Holmes as they come. But you don't have to let those impressions get in the way of objective reasoning. But love is an emotional thing, and whatever is emotional is opposed to that true cold reason which I place above all things. Holmes immediately adds to his acknowledgement of Mary's charm. You can recognize their presence and then consciously cast them aside. You can acknowledge that Jane reminds you of your high school frenemy and then move past it. That emotional luggage doesn't matter nearly as much as you may think it does, and never think that something is an exception. It's not. But oh, how difficult it can be to apply either of these principles. The discounting of emotion, or the need to never make exceptions, no matter how much you may want to, in reality.